Welcome to Physicians Helping Attorneys Helping People. When people are injured due to negligence or while on the job, they need all the help they can get. Doctors Armin Feldman and Mike Bummer help ensure they get it. Join them as they discuss the newest medical subspecialty of medical legal consulting. Learn how attorneys can gain a competitive advantage in PI, workers' comp, and medical malpractice cases. Armin and Mike can help you better understand the medical issues in your cases, leading to larger settlement amounts and the best possible medical care for clients. They can help save you time and increase case value, all without breaking the bank. Let's get started.
Welcome to the episode. I'm Dr. Armin Feldman, and as always, I'm here with my friend, colleague, and partner in Physicians Legal Consultants, Dr. Mike Bummer.
Hi, Armin, and hello to our listeners. Happy to be here. You know, we have a really good episode today. We are going to discuss a few cases that are different, not traditional car crash cases, like is commonly our, you know, bread and butter, how we serve our personal injury and workers' comp attorneys. But also, cases today are going to be a little bit unique, and we're excited to jump into that. And it should be a nice kind of compact, free-flowing episode today.
Right. So we're going to be discussing some negligent cases, but this isn't somebody running through a red light and hitting someone.
Exactly. And we should mention, Armin, if anyone has any questions, you or comments or case, go ahead and email us at comments@physicianshelpingattorneys.com. Find us on LinkedIn. Make sure if you're seeing us on YouTube, which if you're listening on the audio version right now on the podcast, hop over to YouTube. You can see our friendly faces and maybe get to know us a little bit better that way. Drop a comment on the video and or, just reach out. We always love interacting with our guests. We get a few emails a week, and it's always interesting to see the different perspectives that our listeners have, whether you're an attorney or a physician or even someone who just has questions about your own case.
Right. Yeah, absolutely.
So something else before we start, Armin, I got to tell you, on your recommendation over the past week, you were responsible for, I don't know if it's empty hours or not, but I binged, I binged Tokyo Vice on Netflix.
Okay.
It was excellent. Oh my gosh. Thank you for that.
It was a great series.
Like most good series, it took two or three episodes to get into the characters and learn about them, but it was not what I expected. And I would recommend for any of our listeners who enjoy kind of a higher level show with a lot of deep subplots and interesting storylines, check it out. It's highly bingeable, and there's only two seasons. So it's approachable. It's not like you're investing in a 10 season show.
Right. Yeah, it was exciting and well acted. It was great.
How was your weekend?
Good. We went to, for the first time, I'm going to continue our theme here a little bit, but we went for the first time to a Korean restaurant that opened recently. It's called Tofu Story. And they have a lot of other dishes, including, you know, meat dishes, but it's called Tofu Story. They make their own tofu on site. They make their own kimchi on site. And interestingly, they've got a restaurant in Brooklyn, and they just opened one in Denver. And we went with friends. The first thing we noticed, Mike, is everybody else in the restaurant was Korean. So we definitely had come to the right place.
And it's a great sign.
Yeah. So we ordered, everybody ordered, and then all of a sudden, the waitress started putting things down on the table. You couldn't see the table through all of the dishes. All these were little dishes, and they had kimchi and mushrooms and grilled tofu, and I mean, it was fantastic. I mean, it was just delicious. We were oohing and aahing. There was so much food there, we had to take half of it home, but it was really fun.
The next time we're in Denver, we're going to go. I'm going to, that sounds right up our alley.
Great.
So, want to jump into the cases?
Absolutely.
Okay. I'll start today.
Okay.
So, this case involves an obstetrical emergency, and it involves placental abruption. And I know a lot of physicians and probably attorneys who are not in the obstetrical space get very frightened of obstetrical complications, terminology, because it is its own little corner of medicine. You know,
first thing is you have to define that.
Yeah.
Because I think even the physicians listen, many of them won't know what that means.
Unless they think back to their third year of medical school on some standardized test. Yeah.
Right.
So placental abruption is when the placenta separates from the uterine wall. And really the placenta is responsible for providing blood flow and filtering blood between mom and baby. So it's critical. It is the gateway of all nutrition and blood to the baby. So when there's problems with it, it's a big deal. Mm-hmm. And separating from the wall, where all of these microvascular connections occur, can be a very serious emergency, life or death for the baby.
Yeah.
It happens for a number of reasons that are most common. That's why I kind of joke about the testing, because there's those kind of quintessential cases of moms with high blood pressure is one of them. Mm. Moms who abuse drugs, most commonly amphetamines like cocaine. Mm. Anything that affects the vascular system, right, or causes vascular spasm can cause abruption. Another most common cause is trauma. So actually car crashes, I kind of lied. I guess I said we weren't going to be talking about car crashes today, but blunt trauma to the abdomen, unfortunately, right, you know, domestic violence, falling down the stairs. Mm. And those can just cause a separation of the placenta. And the two most common causes or signs of abruption, I should say, are abdominal pain, mm, and bleeding.
So if there's hopefully there is abdominal pain if it happens, because that's going to alert the woman that something is wrong, and hopefully they'll go to emergency room.
That's exactly right. So second and third trimester, which is after 20 weeks, every obstetrician is taught abdominal pain and vaginal bleeding is an abruption until otherwise proven not to be an abruption. It's critical. It's literally a day one lesson. Okay. So this case, and I review many cases that are similar to this. This one involved a young woman who was at home and started bleeding. She was in the beginning of her third trimester, about 28 weeks, and she called EMS. And EMS rushed her to the hospital. She got to the ER, was having some bleeding, and having mild to moderate abdominal pain.
Hmm. So that should ring the bell right there, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
The problem and the reason this case got to my desk to review for merit is that she stayed in the ER about 30 minutes. And it's recorded because these events, the EMS has a log of when they arrive. Mm-hmm. The ER has a log of whenever the patient kind of checks in or when someone registers them. And then there's a log of when this patient arrived to the obstetrical unit, which is where anyone after the second trimester gets evaluated in the obstetrical unit, mm-hmm, because the ER is, again, not really as up to speed with these obstetrical emergencies.
So are you mentioning this time frame because the correct thing is once you know that the patient is having abdominal pain, vaginal bleeding, they should immediately be shipped up to obstetrics?
That's exactly right. It should be as emergent as someone having sharp chest pain,
yeah,
who gets rushed to a cath lab or gets nitroglycerin or there's whatever protocols triggered for those emergencies, this qualifies.
Okay.
And so she actually stayed in the emergency room for, like I said, about a half an hour, and this is well documented, until the paramedics got uneasy and actually took her up mm-hmm. to the OB unit themselves.
Wow, good for them.
And she ended up, once evaluated in the OB unit, they got fetal heart tones that showed bradycardia, which means too slow. Normal fetal heart
too
rate.
Slow heart rate.
Normal fetal heart rate is usually between 120 and 160. And her fetal heart rate at this time was about 80 or 90, which is very, very concerning.
Yeah.
So they did an emergency C-section because they diagnosed her with an abruption that was unstable and the baby was in distress. The baby had very poor APGARs. That's the measure that we use to assess the immediate kind of rough estimate of how a baby is doing in the first 1 and 5 minutes of life. Right. And these APGARs...
I'm sorry I interrupted you, but that's a scoring test, right? I
mean, that's exactly. They look at breathing, Keller, tone of the baby, heart rate, and the APGARs on this baby were 1 and 1, which it's out of a score of 9.
Mm.
So the baby unfortunately did not do well and ended up dying after a couple days in the neonatal unit.
What a shame.
So the attorney got me involved and wanted to know if specifically that delay was within standard of care and or if I felt that it made a causative impact on the outcome.
Yeah.
And lo and behold, you know, there's common sense fails, I think, a lot of our clients, a lot of our attorneys in these matters because... Gosh, Armin, I spend a large portion of my week educating my attorneys on why cases are kind of explainable and reasonable or fall within the fringe of standard of care and probably are not cases. Right. So
complications instead of negligence.
Exactly. And even on this case, the common sense is in the family, you could understand how upset they would be that delay. The common sense is that it was impactful, but it's not a slam dunk. We don't necessarily, without going to the literature and figuring out what the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists suggests, what the standard of care is for an abruption, you don't really know. So I thought the attorney was really, really smart getting me involved. You know, we do this work in a couple hours time. It's extremely affordable. And it can save them large retainers, like $4,000 or $5,000 retainers for an expert. So what I found, kind of cut to the chase and then let you take the baton for your case. But what I found in the literature very clearly, and this is what really broke this case open, is that ACOG has a small but well-powered study of about 30 to 40 moms that looked at response time to abruption and outcome. And they actually have published that babies with abruption who were delivered within 20 minutes of detecting that abruption have a significantly better outcome than babies who were delivered after 20 minutes. And what that allowed us to do is really make the argument that this delay was meaningful and probably significantly had a negative impact on this baby's ability to thrive because there was, like with most abruptions, these are not chronic issues that the baby was unhealthy leading up to it. Like a lot of obstetrical conditions, babies don't thrive or they don't grow correctly and then they have complications and then you don't really know if the complication in the end was the cause or not. With an abruption, usually everything's just fine until that separation occurs.
Right.
And so this attorney and I went back and forth. I remember the call, you know, we discussed it for probably about 45 minutes and really went through why and how this abruption likely impacted the outcome and what the response was. Because once the obstetrical team got involved, they did everything correctly.
Yeah.
It really was a hospital system error.
Yeah.
And actually for our attorneys, as we know, that's oftentimes a better fact for them because it wasn't really a judgment decision. this was a failure of the system. And
right.
juries and lay people can really sink their teeth into when a system fails someone.
Right, right. Well, sad case, but I think informative, educational for our listeners.
Yeah, and then the follow-up, Armin, is this attorney asked me to find a well-credentialed expert who shared the similar opinion and was able to easily do that and delivered the expert, and the case, you know, moved well on and progressed.
Yeah.
So let's hear what you got. What's your case today?
Okay, well, that was a good case, Mike. I mean, sad case, but good case. So I have a case in which there's negligence, but it wasn't medical. Well, maybe it was to a degree, medical negligence, but the main issue was negligence. And interestingly enough, Mike, it's a systems issue. We didn't discuss this in advance, but it's a systems issue. So this is a case of a 47-year-old woman, and she was arrested on July 21st, 2022, and she was charged with a DUID, driving under the influence of drugs. And by the way, my attorney asked me to review the case in October of 2022. So the client reported that no history of alcohol abuse, no history of drinking before she got in the car and subsequently got arrested. However, she did admit to having taken an unknown number of 15 milligram oxycodone pills just prior to driving. So she reports that she was seeing her chiropractor for neck pain, and I'll come back to that in just a minute. But by the time she got in her car, she was in severe pain. So she took an oxycodone pill, 15 milligrams, and I'll tell you why she was taking those anyway. And apparently she was in pain, and maybe her judgment got impaired, probably shouldn't have taken the first one, right? But obviously took more than one and can't even remember how many she took. Well, several drivers on the road called in and reported to the police that someone was driving erratically. And so that's what led to her arrest. So she was incarcerated in one of our county jails. We have a 5-county area here in the Denver area. So she was incarcerated in one of the county jails after her arrest. And her booking, this is kind of important, but her booking information reports that she was booked in at 9:30 p.m.
Okay.
So now, this client also had been taking Xanax, alprazolam, but I'm just going to call it Xanax so I don't call it by two names. But she'd been taking Xanax 10 milligrams twice a day for anxiety for about 2 years. And she had been prescribed the Xanax for anxiety off and on since her 20s. And she had obviously she had an anxiety disorder. She wasn't abusing the medication, but she was taking that amount. And when the most recent episode of anxiety started, she got back on the Xanax and had been taking it for a while, as I just said. So now she also had been taking oxycodone, 15 milligrams twice a day for about 3 years for chronic pain, secondary to a surgical fusion procedure done to stabilize her neck. And she had a fusion from C4 to T1. I mean, that's a big fusion, right?
Yeah.
And the reason that she had that is she was in a limousine, and the limousine was rear-ended, and she was thrown around and probably had, you probably had a whiplash event and had several ruptured discs, and that ultimately resulted in that fusion surgery.
Okay.
Now, I think it's also important to know that the client had no past history of alcohol or drug abuse. And interestingly enough, I read in the medical record that in August, way after this event, well, a month or so after this event, she actually went to her primary care doctor and said, I think I got to get off or reduce this dose of oxycodone. So, I mean, she's basically a responsible person who was irresponsible on this thing, right?
Okay.
And they had started reducing the oxycodone amount, and the primary care doctor was suggesting she be switched to buprenorphine, which is a medication that is used for opiate withdrawal. And the way it works is it doesn't cause any of the high or the euphoria or the reason why people abuse opiates, but it does stop the withdrawal effects. And so over a fairly long period of time, I mean, you can inch down the dosage of the buprenorphine and get people off opiates.
Okay.
It just says something about the nature of who she was, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so she was actually released from custody on July 24th, but on July 23rd, she had a grand mal seizure, and she fell on the concrete floor of her cell. And she bilaterally fractured her maxilla. That's the upper jawbone. And the fractures were horizontal. And by the way, that's called a Lafort fracture. And on the day of the grand mal seizure, there was an incident report note. And I'm probably going to read this. So it states that she was, when they found her, she was observed lying face down on the floor in a pool of blood. And the incident report goes on to state, it was written by an RN, that they attended to her immediately after they realized that she had had this problem. Now, she was complaining of facial pain and swelling, and she was taken to one of our big county hospitals that's known for outstanding trauma treatment. It's got one of the best trauma centers in around, really, in the country. So she was seen in the emergency room. The diagnosis of the fractures were made, and that led to a surgical repair being done a couple of days later. Now, these fractures are rated on a 1-4 scale, and she had a level 1 fracture on the left side and level 3 fracture on the right side. So, and she was still in the hospital, but they discharged her from the jail, on the 23rd. So she did go on to have a pretty, well, at the time, you know, it looked like she was going to have a pretty good recovery from the fracture and the surgical procedure. At the time that I was reviewing this, another surgery would need to be planned to remove some of the hardware in the jaw. So she was going to have two surgeries, two anesthesias, and so forth. So the question that my attorney asked me is, well, what was the cause of the grand mal seizure while she was incarcerated in the county jail? And so one of the things that I did, obviously, is I read all of the documentation from the county jail. And there was a note when she was admitted to the jail from an LPN. And again, I'm going to read this. And in that note, it said, Xanax and oxycodone, both medications non-formulary and will not be continued here per our medical protocol. And the note also said she was going to be placed on a benzo/opiate watch, which I have no idea what that means, right? Because, but so they abruptly stopped these two medications. There's also kind of an interesting thing in the note. The LPN said that the inmate could kite for the medications. And apparently in the language of the personnel in jail, or at least this jail, kite means you can contact your own physician and have them write a letter saying that the inmate needs certain medications. But obviously this could take days.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's start with the Xanax having been abruptly stopped. So in the physician's desk reference, the PDR, it indicates that Xanax is a short-acting anti-anxiety medication, and that's an important factor in what happened. So in an article in Clinical Pharmacokinetics, the authors report that Xanax is considered a drug with a short half-life. And a half-life is defined as the time required for half the quantity of a drug deposited in a living organism to be metabolized or eliminated by normal biological processes. So this article said that the normal half-life for Xanax is 9 to 16 hours.
Okay.
So, and a lot of other journal articles corroborated that time frame. Now, I think something else that's important to note, in an article I read in Clinical Psychiatry, the authors reported that even with a gradual withdrawal of Xanax in patients taking 2 to 9 milligrams per day for anxiety for 1 to 5 years, that these patients, even in these controlled situations, can suffer from severe reactions, including anxiety, sleep disturbance, rage reactions, hyperalertness, increased nightmares, intrusive thoughts, and some other things. So the reason that I brought this up and I put it in my report is to emphasize the fact, even in controlled situations, when you withdraw this medication, it can cause problems. Now, there are many, many, many umpty-umpty articles in the medical literature that report if you abruptly stop Xanax in patients with long-term use, like this client, they are subject to seizures.
Yeah.
And it turns out, by the way, the timing, she was probably at zero amount of Xanax in her blood at the time, on the day and at the time of day that she had this grand mal seizure.
Imagine how much she probably suffered in the hours leading up to that seizure.
Yes.
That actually right. makes me feel, my heart really goes out to someone like that, regardless of their situation and what happened. But that's torture.
Yeah, you stole some of my thunder. Because the other thing, I'm going to talk about the oxycodone in a moment. But she certainly was in withdrawal from the oxycodone. And that's a miserable thing to go through. Because she had had this abrupt stoppage of the Xanax, she also had this horrible grand mal seizure with the fractures. So, and by the way, in another medical journal article I read, it said that patients who are on short-acting benzodiazepines, Xanax and Valium and so forth, are benzodiazepines. But patients that are on short-acting benzodiazepines are more prone to these seizures. So it was obvious, I mean, I don't even think you need to be a doctor, right? But it was obvious that because the Xanax was stopped abruptly, that it was the immediate and proximate cause of this seizure and subsequent jaw fracture. So the other thing I think it's important to note is that it's pretty well accepted that medical doctor, you were shaking your head when I said the Xanax was abruptly stopped. And it's pretty accepted that medical doctors and nurses should know that the abrupt stoppage of this medication sets makes people prone to having seizures. And so it's something that really shouldn't have been missed. And this is something of an aside, but it's hard for me to believe that the standard procedure in the jail is to stop all medications for inmates. I mean, other things could happen too, right?
You know, that was my follow-up question for you. The medicine on this, clearly you were invaluable to your attorney on educating them on the details. You had quoted some research, but I'm curious from the attorney's perspective on, you know, I'm sure they had to pull jail and incarceration protocols and what is standard for how these medications are handled, because this happens every day. So that really seems right. Like a failure, like you said, of that system.
Right.
And gosh, what a horrible outcome. It's completely unnecessary.
Yeah. So I'll just mention briefly that I don't think that the abruptly stopping the oxycodone had anything to do with the seizure. It was the Xanax, but it certainly put her in a position to have a miserable time of it. So that's really the upshot of the case, and that it was my medical opinion to reasonable degree and medical probability that there was negligence there, and there was a direct causal relationship between the abrupt stopping and what happened to her subsequently.
That's great.
And I was out of the case at that point.
Yeah. Right?
But I assume what the attorney would have done is say there's negligence and there are damages here that need to be compensated.
What a great couple cases today, Armin. You know, we get these questions and each one is so unique and it seems like it lives on an island by itself, but this is exactly what we are able to do efficiently, affordably, and quickly for our attorneys. I know we were looking for some interesting things to talk about today. I think we nailed it. I'm really happy that we could share these today.
Right. I think sometimes it's good if we do something other than the client was rear-ended. Right?
Yeah.
And these cases are not close to being in those categories.
Well, let's wrap it up. If anyone listening wants to give feedback, has a case, just wants to interact with us and say hello, feel free to email us at comments@physicianshelpingattorneys.com. Find us on LinkedIn. Make sure you subscribe. If you're on YouTube or if you're on your podcast app, go ahead and follow us. And we always enjoy feedback and interacting with our listeners.
Right. And if you're an attorney and you have a case that you're scratching your head about, you have a case that you'd like us to take a look at, we would certainly encourage you to get a hold of us at comments@physicianshelpingattorneys.com. And thanks for all of our loyal listeners. And we look forward to having you on the next episode.
Thanks for listening to Physicians Helping Attorneys Helping People. For more information about the show and to listen to all the podcast episodes, go to physicianshelpingattorneys.com. You can also email Armin and Mike at comments@physicianshelpingattorneys.com.